It was 1 year ago. 1 year ago today when Hurricane Katrina devastated all of the Gulf Coast. The mainstream media can be counted on to replay the scenes from last year. They'll probably point to the crime. I've seen her start already. Or they'll point to some of the negative factors about the population that happened after that horrible event. On today's show, I would like to point out that oil is behind this disaster because oil and its massive use and carbon dioxide pollutants has caused climate change. It's caused global warming. Some people may still not accept that and believe that, but to not even think about it is to be totally ignorant of what happened down in New Orleans last year.
Category 3 strength super hurricane strikes the New York area on average every 70 years. And the last big one hit 68 years ago.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
How bad was the last megastorm? Take a look at the legendary fury of 1938's Long Island Express. The hurricane that tore New England apart. Now, experts say the next big hurricane may be coming. And the next one that targets the East Coast could hit New York City. In the event of a powerful hurricane, one major factor will seal New York City's fate. Its location.
New York City is a coastal town. We have 478 miles of a shorefront in this city.
In fact, Manhattan is surrounded by water on all sides. And when the water arrives, it will come rushing toward 8.2 million New Yorkers, 2 million of them living directly in its path.
We have the largest concentration of people and structures on any hurricane-prone coastline in America.
This Category 3 hurricane's approach to New York will be deceptively quick and deadly.
The sky will be very clear.
Many times before the hurricane hits, it's bright sunshine.
As New Yorkers soak up the sun, the hurricane hurtles northward, propelled by the jet stream. For the Big Apple, time is almost up. The storm's powerful and violent winds roar directly on top of Manhattan's iconic skyline. Anything not bolted down turns into shrapnel, transforming Times Square into a war zone.
High wind velocities create vacuums and pop windows out.
Shattered windows pierce the air like daggers.
Hopefully no one's on the street. If they are, it won't be just glass falling down on them. It'll be glass being blown through the city like razor blades.
But the winds are only the first taste of the hurricane's fury. Now, the hurricane's eye invades New York Bay, pushing along a three-story high wall of water, the massive storm surge. A flood of almost biblical proportions inundates America's playground, wiping out its storied past. Tunnels and subways turn into underground rivers.
When you have a hurricane, you get salt water. You're not talking about pumping out the subways, you're talking about rebuilding them. Many of the familiar parts of New York, such as Chinatown and Wall Street, will literally be underwater.
This could easily surpass Katrina as the largest disaster that this country has ever seen, both in life and property.
Yes, it's true that there should never have been a residential habitation put on wetland and a marshland and a delta that was 12 miles already below sea level. That was just asking for a disaster. But why did that happen? Well, we can look at corporations and how they run society and therefore politics and how they run society as the result of people being so desperate that they do move into areas that are questionable as far as being safe. And of course, we now know, and we did know it as it happened, that the majority of the residents down there in the worst hit areas like Ward 9 were black people, poor black people. And we also saw shots that showed how people, even with money, couldn't escape because the roads were instantaneously clogged up, overwhelmed with automobile traffic trying to leave. They ended up sitting on highways for hours and hours. So we do have to pay attention to one of the worst natural disasters that ever happened in the American soil. And we have to ask ourselves seriously, is there another way that we could live without burning so many fossil fuels? I want to read you something I pulled from the Toronto Star just last Saturday, actually. It's finally somebody saying about how people should not go back and rebuild in some areas down at New Orleans for good reason. And this story was written by Tim Harper from the Washington Bureau. A year later, assurances that hurricane-ravaged New Orleans could find its way back from destruction are being retracted. The people of the Lower Ninth Ward believe that they aren't welcome back, that they're convinced that the city doesn't want them back. They believe that there's a conspiracy afoot to convince people that the water isn't fit for consumption and to make them think that the neighborhood sits too low and will inevitably be wiped out again. Today's speakers are coming from a conference that was held the 12th of October in 2005. The group was called Common Will Conference, and we have a lawyer, Monique Hardin, and we also have a doctor, Dr. Paul Epstein, talking about some of the pollutants that were left behind.
Again, over these same communities. So where the communities were starting to dig out in the rural areas, they were just inundated. And I want to tell you about what this sludge was. I've been going into the areas since day four of Katrina. I first went in to do assessments on September the 2nd. The water bottoms that a lot of us work with at the national level and state level about naming contaminated water bottoms, naming the sediments, and identifying what chemicals are in those sediments were lifted up by the tidal surge and placed all over the land. Some places it was a couple of feet thick as it was very wet and mucky, and then it would dry down to 6 inches or 3 inches. But just picture the whole landscape of that geographic area I told you about, just covered with this contaminated sludge. Based on data, that contaminated sludge contains volatile organics, which soon evaporate when the sludge starts to dry. Polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons, which are semi-volatile, so they stay in the sludge and don't evaporate. They stay in as it starts drying. And heavy metals like arsenic and lead and cadmium and chromium. And the majority of these chemicals are over the EPA's residential standard. So if it was a Superfund site or if it was a waste site, that sludge as soil on the top of the ground would not be allowed to have people move in and establish a residential area. Now, on September the 16th, I was in collecting samples in a large number of these areas where this sludge was very thick, coating everything, coating streets, coating yards, coating houses. And that afternoon late, the parish officials or county commissioners in a number of these parishes went to the head of the health agency and said, "We want to let our people go in tomorrow." The head of the health agency knew it was an unacceptable risk, but didn't have the political strength to say no to them. So the next day, people were allowed to go in. They waded through this toxic sludge, which also had high levels of E. coli and all the enteric organisms that come with sewage that has not been treated. Waded through the bacteria, waded through the sludge, went into their homes, which were just an incubator for all this mold. So these people started becoming ill, didn't have access to 9/11, didn't have access to health clinics, and they went in for just a day to sort of retrieve some of the things from their house and have a look-see, and they started getting sick, respiratory problems, asthma, skin rashes, sores that wouldn't heal, sores that don't respond to normal antibiotic treatment. Now, that is starting to dry up. After Hurricane Rita flooded all the areas, in the upper areas, Orleans, upper part of St. Bernard, upper part of Plaquemine, Terrebonne and Lafourche, it's starting to dry up. The lower parts of those parishes are still totally underwater from Rita. And as it dries up, it's turning to dust. Now, there are a lot of emergency responders in there going back and forth with track hose and all kind of equipment. No protective gear, no respirators. Every now and then you'll see a dust mask. And I have been making this point to EPA constantly, over and over. Those responders need to be protected. Yesterday when I was in there, the responders had on Tyvek suits, had on gloves, had on the booties, and had respirators available. A lot of them were still wearing them around their neck because you have to remember temperatures in the high 90s with the heat index of 110. In the long run, the processes are not working. Elected officials are deciding when certain areas will be open, allowing people to go in. They become contaminated, become sick. And when a lot of people are talking about rebuilding, revitalizing, and all these processes, those processes are happening somewhere else, not on the ground. The West Bank, which is across the Mississippi River from New Orleans, totally populated, very few services available. Electricity's back on. Traffic jams, horrendous. All those people move back in with very little services, and that's what's happening in New Orleans. They're starting to move in as soon as they have electricity. They're not protected, and it's going to be really difficult to implement some of these redevelopment and safety processes that a lot of the people on, and this is no offense, a lot of people on the fringes, because I'm in the field and I see it happening, and they're moving back in, and they're going to go live in those houses in the Ninth Ward.
I went out with just a little boy, standing to my daddy.
This next speaker is Dr. Paul Epstein, and he is Associate Director for the Center for Health and Global Environment. If you want to find out more about what he has written and talked about, you can go to Climate Health, which is http://www.gcrio.org. And you could just do a Google search on the New England Journal of Medicine. Look for the October the 6th, 2005 issue. And his article is called Climate Change and Human Health.
I just want to start out by adding a couple of questions to Charlotte's eloquent beginning. I would say what the two questions that arise for me, can this event and this...
So, Dr. Epstein, there's been a lot written in the media about global warming and climate change. What are the aspects of climate change that have the greatest effects on human health?
Some of the direct impacts from climate change involve heat waves, asthma, results of storms and flooding, and then the impact on infectious disease. Heat waves have increased in frequency, in duration, in geographic extent over the last century, and now we see the opposite. We saw flooding in Central Europe, and we've seen the opposite here with Hurricane Katrina. So this is becoming more common, wide swings from heat and drought to heavy rains and flooding. Warming is changing the conditions conducive to transmission of malaria, dengue fever, yellow fever, Japanese bee encephalitis, West Nile virus. As we see winters warm, we're seeing suitable conditions for transmission, increase in latitude and altitude. The clearest sign we're seeing is in the mountains, where we know that the glaciers are retreating, the permafrost is melting, plant communities are moving up, and we're seeing mosquitoes circulate at higher altitudes. Malaria is now circulating in Nairobi, which is a mile-high city. So this is a pattern now in Asia, Latin America, and Africa, where mountain areas are thawing and mosquitoes are flourishing. Even more important for malaria is the extreme weather that accompanies global warming. So we've seen floods in Mozambique, for instance. In 2000, there was flooding for 6 weeks, three cyclones. There was a five-fold increase in malaria following that flooding. We're seeing waterborne disease in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. As we look at extreme events, we see this clustering of infectious disease. Hurricane Katrina, which came across the Atlantic, picked up a lot of head of steam as it moved over the very warm Gulf of Mexico. It went from a Category 1 as it swiped the tip of Florida to a Category 5 and back to 4, but its breath was enormous because of the amount of moisture it's picking up from the very warm Gulf of Mexico. So it's that warming of the water that is fueling these storms. Last year, 2004, we had four major hurricanes to hit Florida. Not since 1886 have we seen four hurricanes hit one state. But there were also 20 typhoons in the Pacific, and 10 of those hit Japan. There was intense flooding in Central Europe in 2002. This is no longer just one event and is one event associated with global warming. We're seeing years now of extreme weather events. What we're seeing in the inner cities is high concentrations of carbon dioxide. There's something called the heat island effect in the cities, so that the temperatures in the middle of Boston are 7 degrees Fahrenheit greater than in the suburban and rural areas. With this heat island effect, there's also a carbon dioxide dome. So we get trapping of carbon dioxide. The surprise for public health has been that we've found that ragweed, when grown under double carbon dioxide, makes 60% more pollen. So in abandoned lots, we see more ragweed and railways and so on along the roads. We're seeing very high counts of asthma in the inner cities. Global warming is also changing the timing of seasons. So we're seeing trees flower 3 and 4 weeks earlier in New England. And that means that the spring allergy season is getting pushed up and prolonged.
Here he talks about where he thinks West Nile disease came from.
We don't think climate change brought it, and it appeared in 99, and we don't know how it got there. It could have been a mosquito, it could have been a bird, it could have been a human that was infected. But what we do know is that the mosquitoes that transmit West Nile virus increase their numbers during drought. Turns out that the mosquitoes that carry West Nile live in the city. They're urban dwellers. They live in the city drains and the catch basins, and when there's a spring drought, there's a little bit of water left in, so it's that foul water in which these Culex pipiens mosquitoes grow. So these Culex pipiens live in the drains during droughts, and they start biting birds in the spring, and we get this cycle of bird-biting mosquitoes and birds infected. For instance, in the summer of 2002, there was a drought throughout the country. It was a very dry summer. That's the summer that West Nile raced across the country, going to 44 states and D.C., five Canadian provinces, and was strongest in areas with the most intense drought. It's the extremes in weather, be they drought or heavy rains, that are most destabilizing to these biological systems that are so important for keeping diseases and disease carriers in check.
This is another interview done with Dr. Paul Epstein over the phone by the same group, Common Will Conference.
Floods on almost every continent, and this kind of series of storms, this is diagnostic of a descriptive of a changing climate. We know that climate is changing. We know that humans are contributing. We know that biological systems are responding on every continent, and we know that weather is more extreme. These are the four major conclusions of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 2001. We know a lot more since then, which is that the deep oceans are warming and that the heat that's been accumulating in the atmosphere is buried in the oceans, and this is what fuels these storms. This is, so we understand the pattern, we see a different pattern, and we understand the dynamics, and several studies, as I'm sure people are now aware of, in the last 2 months, have shown that since the 1970s, Category 4 and 5 storms have almost doubled, and the intensity and destructiveness of storms, which is a function of their peak winds and their duration, has doubled in the last 35 years. And I might say parenthetically, some of the scientists doing these studies just a year ago were naysayers themselves, said hurricanes would increase 5% by 2080, and that's about all we can say. And now the reality and their own work has transformed their politics, I would jump to. Another paper by also someone who was a skeptic found that 84% of the global warming of the last century has accumulated in the oceans, and that the pattern is unmistakably attributable to human activities. This convinced this man, Tim Barnett, from Scripps Institution for Oceanography, to conclude that we're in it and this is happening. Let me conclude this by saying we're in it and it's happening in a pace and magnitude that none of the scientists envisioned just several years ago. The rate of change, the variability, the stresses on all parts of the Earth systems, of the cryosphere, the ice, the bathysphere, the ocean, the biosphere on land, the atmosphere, and even the stratosphere from human activity is unmistakable and is destabilizing the climate system and the feedbacks that help to hold it together. So the victims here and this horrendous experience with waves, I would say, 28 feet, the levees were 13 feet, the waves coming off of the Caribbean, off of the Gulf of Mexico, were 90 feet, and the platforms, the 4,000 platforms, are 55 feet. So this is really a scenario of imagining the unmanageable, we would say, and looking at the magnitude of change, it is swamping our defenses. Let me try to wrap some things together, because I know we should have a conversation. Oil, I believe, ties this together. As we look at the life cycle of oil and its health and ecological and economic dimensions, we see enormous health and environmental and potentially economic crises looming. Let me add that on top of all of these toxins and persistent organic pollutants that are now spread in the Gulf, we're counting 8 million gallons of oil that's spilled, and the count isn't over. I remind you, Exxon Valdez was 11 million gallons. So this is on the order of magnitude of the Exxon Valdez. Little attention to this aspect. If we look at the life cycle of oil, we look at the exploration, the extraction, and we know the damage that that does in the Gulf, the 4,000 platforms, the areas of dead zones, which has to do with that drilling, as well as the nutrients coming off that come off in floods. But we know what's happened in the Nigerian Delta, the Ecuadorian head of the Amazon. We know what's going on in terms of the destruction of extraction as we look at the Arctic and are fearful of more. Then we come to transport and transport of crude, and that itself leads to more leaks than the amount of spills that we experience in headlines. And then we come to the refineries, and we're all aware of where they're placed, what they emit. Benzene is one of the chemicals that causes liver cancer. This, we know that being in refinery areas is not good for our health, and as I said, we know how they are located. And then we come to transport again. We have the refined material, and again, the leaks and the spills and the contamination of shores and the impact on wildlife and the impact on fisheries and livelihoods. And then finally, we come to combustion. We have air pollution, which we know well. We have acid precipitation, which we have not recovered from. And then there's climate change, which is the icing, or perhaps the de-icing on the cake, as it were. We're seeing enormous health consequences of climate change, from vector-borne disease, from heat wave direct impacts, and now these enormous clusters of ills from toxics and infectious agents in the wake of these kinds of disasters that, as you alluded to, is now a similar size in Central America, in Guatemala, Honduras, etc. Then we look at the impacts on ecosystems themselves of the heat and the warming and the extremes combined with infectious diseases that are affecting wildlife and livestock and crops and forests and marine life. You've heard enough, but the point is that the same climate change, infectious diseases, and persistent organic pollutants are stalking the very life support systems that provide us with food and water and air. So finally, let me say, I think there's enormous opportunities in this whole crisis, and this reconstruction, smart growth, protective, the public health and safety, this, along with all of the clean energy solutions and the removal of oil from the equation, with hybrids, with smart technologies, with tidal and wind and solar and geothermal, this can be the engine of growth for this 21st century. This can bring together some agendas that are coming together of a crisis of energy, a crisis of the environment, and a crisis that's being felt in the boardrooms of Wall Street on a financial level, if not through every industry.
This is Heather Sarantis from the Breast Cancer Fund, and just a couple comments. First, I want to thank you so much for doing this call, because I think, you know, the response to Hurricane Katrina shows us so much about our national character in terms of the environment, human health, race, politics. It's just been really eye-opening and really sad in many ways. And just two quick announcements. One is that while we were on this call, the EPA sent out in their daily press release saying that they've released public service announcements on mold and sediment contents and all of that. So they're doing those in English and Spanish. And if you go to the EPA homepage, you can see how they're presenting that to the public. And the other thing I wanted to let you know about is that there was recently released the Public Health and Environmental Equity Act, which would essentially prevent the rollback of environmental and health standards in the rebuilding of the New Orleans area and for all future natural disasters. And Breast Cancer Fund has an action on our website at breastcancerfund.org/action if you want to support this. I think it's a really important piece of legislation, especially since we've already seen the rollback in regulations on permitting of oil rigs and whatnot.
Hello, this is Terry Collins from Carnegie Mellon University. Among the various things that you're finding on the ground, what worries you most? One point is that I worry that perhaps there may be radionuclides or dioxins, etc., and you were talking about, for example, the Superfund sites that are problematic. These probably are the highest priority issue for dealing with. What do you have any wisdom on that?
I think there's a whole host of things. What worries me in the short term is the bacteria that the people become exposed to, as well as the mold when they go in their house, but the toxins that they come into contact through skin absorption, inhalation, and ingestion. And it's the whole combination. It isn't just one. We're actually doing some samples around sites that have known dioxin problems to see how much of that has moved off, but that data is not available yet. But it's just a whole host. And EPA's data confirms the kind of data I've been generating. It says that these things are over the standards, but they say they recommend that people don't come in contact with the sludgy, sedimenty material. But if they drive into their community now, so much of it is becoming airborne, they come in contact with it just through breathing. So it's a really combination of toxicity and potential biological hazards.
This is Peter Whitehouse from Case Western Reserve University. This is just a comment. In Washington, at the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities, we're having a special panel on whether Katrina is evidence of the failure of bioethics as a source of conversation about values in medicine, based on a paper that was written by Jonathan Marino, who is the head staff person for the NBAC Bioethics Commission. So anybody that's interested in my own interest, which is, how can bioethics be a force for moving medicine to thinking about the implications of Katrina more deeply? Please contact me at peter.whitehouse@case.edu. My email is part of the participant list.
Chemical Sensitivity Foundation. I'm writing a book on chemical sensitivity, and there will be a chapter on the Exxon Valdez cleanup workers who are now ill, and a chapter on 9/11, a chapter on Gulf War Syndrome. And I probably will want to make some reference to the Katrina toxic exposures. So I would appreciate very much if anyone who has information on this or receives information over the next couple months will contact me. Our website is chemicalsensitivityfoundation.org, because I think Katrina will be so similar to the 9/11 situation and these other situations. I would be glad to Oh, by the way, my book, I will be giving a copy, free copy, to every member of Congress. So it will have
Thanks,
an effect
Sarah.
On Congress.
Thanks. Another question, please.
This is Lynn Nelson. I'm at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. I wanted to ask any or all three of you to comment on the media coverage. I know that was mentioned in the beginning, but I noticed a headline the other day that on the order of water not so bad, nothing looks quite as bad as worse fear, that kind of thing. Could you comment on how the media is handling this and what you see in the way of a more independent, well-grounded reporting on this?
Who wants to start?
Initially, the media was all focused on New Orleans, and probably rightly so, but what happened because of that focus, there wasn't any response in the more rural areas.
And so those people were desperately in need, and other people had to go in and start providing them with the resources they needed. Now the media is telling us that people are getting tired of hearing the story and don't want to hear it. So I think that plays into the hands with, oh, the water wasn't so bad, oh, the sediment wasn't so bad. If you actually look at the EPA data, it shows that there are things exceeding the criteria. If you look at the independent data, it shows. But you have to balance that against what the political perspective needs to be. They wanted to be able to discharge the water into Lake Pontchartrain, knowing the risk, but they had to get it off of the land and into the lake. They need to get the people back into their homes, regardless of what kind of contamination is in their yards and in their homes. So it's an uneven balancing on that perspective, and the media is playing right into it.
Paul Bogart from the Healthy Building Network. I guess my question is sort of a general question to the panelists about what are the needs from here on out with respect to the monitoring program that Monique just described briefly with respect to rebuilding efforts. What are the needs as those of you, Monique and Wilma, in the Gulf region in terms of funding, in terms of cooperation from the environmental community around rebuilding and other efforts?
Who wants to do that one first?
I'll go first. This is Monique Harden. There are immediate needs and then are huge long-term macro needs. The immediate needs are dealing with the social and political issues around the right of return, being able to allow and give people the opportunity to return to their homes and reestablish themselves in their communities. And part of fulfilling that need is developing and constructing homes for people. And this is through that addressing that need, there definitely is the opportunity for building homes that are energy efficient and that use sustainable materials in the construction. And there are a number of groups that are pursuing that, from groups that have never looked at the issue of green building before, like ACORN, activists and organizations who are really being sophisticated and contacting and working with architects skilled in green building construction, as well as funding institutions to finance this kind of housing development, not just in New Orleans, but also in the Gulf Coast communities. I think the thing to keep in mind is that such housing is one of the major challenges is how rebuilding takes place in a way that could potentially leave out displaced residents and create a major gentrification kind of a program. And it's those groups, including my organization, that are working to make sure that we can have green, affordable housing for displaced residents.
I think the issue is, how do you insert that into the process? And I don't see it getting inserted effectively yet. And I think the rebuilding is going to occur. And so we need to develop a mechanism whereby all of these groups that are working on all the things Monique talked about, and Paul, the kinds of things you do, how do we get them inserted in the process? It's really easy to go into a community of 40 homes, African American, and say, we're here to help you in revitalizing. And a lot of groups are doing that. But it's harder to get it into the broader area where all this will be occurring. And it's decisions that are already been made. People have already hired contractors to come in. It's happening now. How do we get those processes implemented into the overall process?
I do think it is an opportunity to raise all of these questions that are being asked. How to reconstruct so that this is ecologically sound, that it provides a greater measure of security, but also enhances the signals to create new technologies, new kinds of growth of cities that can provide a whole new impetus to the economy. And the key issue here is that the public sector has got to be involved. And there is no question on the part of even the businesses that they're looking at a public program of funds, of subsidies, of tax incentives, of bond issues, of basic infrastructure, which none of the private sector will build. So this is a real turning point in looking at the role of the public and the balance of public and private sectors. Now, we're well aware that this is not something that the current administration is going to emphasize or even fulfill. There's a Paul Krugman piece in the New York Times yesterday or Sunday that just talked about the extreme doubts as to whether Bush will even come through with the things that he has promised. I don't mean to make this all partisan discussion, but I think that we're looking forward to an election year of Congress, and it's very important to put this kind of solution of ecological restoration and protection along with a clean energy transition to deal with the upstream drivers of these kinds of events, as well as the downstream mess that results from them. And we've got to come up with some clear messages that how the public sector and the new Congress can provide the support for a whole new type of construction and a whole new energy system.
If I might ask, this is Terry from JSI. I just would like a sense of what's the most urgent thing for those of us listening to this call to do next, or to support your efforts.
Monique Wilma?
I think it's really focusing in on two things. One, ensuring that environmental conditions are safe and healthy for people, understanding the complete political lockdown on EPA at this point in time to actually carry out that particular mission that it has. And then the second thing is focusing on this fossil fuel economy that we have. I think the issues of climate change, I want to just piggyback on some of the comments that Dr. Epstein made earlier, that the issue of environmental justice and climate change, people are coming together. There is a climate justice coalition here in the United States that's coordinated and housed in the organization Redefining Progress that brings together the issues of not just the direct, immediate, short-term effects of living near and around power plants and oil refineries and their derivative products, but also looking at that in terms of the environmental justice issues that are global with regards to people who are living in delta areas and other regions of the world that are targeted for some of the more intense natural disasters that can happen through climate change and have happened through climate change. So those are the two things. We really just need to amp up the work that we're doing around those two particular issue areas.
Wilma, what would you add?
We moved from the response mode, which we're still in a lot of these areas. Once the refugees were moved to shelters, those communities in which the shelters were located sort of took over and helped them get all the needs they had. What we're seeing now as we move to the response mode is it's just happening. It's happening very quickly. We're seeing huge number of Hispanic laborers being brought in to do the grunt work, and they are also being hugely exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, all the discussion we just had about the changing the landscape, changing the mindset, that needs to be done right now or else the recovery mode is going to happen, and we're still going to be trying to figure out how to insert that in place. And, I mean, I'm in there frequently, and I see the recovery's well underway. And none of this is playing in any decisions. Each kind of contractor now has all their little signs, just like election signs and all the boulevards, and that's how people are choosing who they call and who they engage to fix their homes. And these other things are not weighing in into that process.
Well, I'd like to add to that, too. I think the question was very pertinent, and how Che and how this community can help catalyze this discussions among the various components of the environmental movement. I think this is a crucial moment for that, and it can play a role both in the immediate construction and in the long-term political issues that affects every level of that. So I would hope that there be some conference calls, some conferences among environmental justice groups and those that are working on global change issues, and explore the common grounds. And again, I think the dominance of oil, as all of the life cycle I spelled out, plus its origin in petrochemicals, pesticides, and pop.
Okay, so there you have it. That's the good doctor and some other specialists' take on the pollution. And they say what I was saying at the beginning of the show: if it wasn't for oil, we wouldn't have all of this disaster, and we would not have the pollution that we have down there now. I wanted to let you know about something else that's been talked about, and this is common. This is in the Star, talking about the waste of FEMA. Now, we heard about how FEMA wasn't very effective in the first place and didn't do the job of rescuing people, wasn't set up. But, of course, they had their sticky fingers in the pie when it came to restoring loss. It became a global catchphrase for ineptitude, the word FEMA, for a world where vanity and self-preservation triumphed over compassion. And the ill-timed and ill-advised tribute from George W. Bush to the soon-to-be-disgraced head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency was, "Brownie, you've done a heck of a job." Well, Michael Brown is a man who appeared to be more interested in his moose hair than the suffering of Hurricane Katrina victims. And he's gone everywhere in the past year, from CNN to Playboy, trying to rehabilitate his image. Meanwhile, it was an open question whether FEMA will ever regain its reputation. R. David Paulson, a man who took the top job at FEMA on an acting basis after Brown's resignation, then inherited it full-time after others turned it down, frightened away by either the rebuilding job at hand or the potential damage to their own successful private careers. Paulson appears to be the anti-Brown, a sober, soft-spoken man who doesn't look like somebody who put his television image at the top of his priority list, as did Brown, who was exposed in a series of self-incriminating emails. But Paulson, 59, a former Miami-Dade fire chief and federal fire administrator, also knows the task at hand as he seeks to salvage the reputation of the agency he now heads. He said, "We cannot let the death and the suffering of those Katrina victims go in vain." But he also realizes that trying to regain trust, particularly in the Gulf region where FEMA is an object of derision and open hostility, it's a huge task. He says, "It's going to be how we perform. You know, I could stand up there and say all I want about how great FEMA is going to be and how good we're going to perform in the future," Paulson says. "But until we actually do it and prove it, people aren't going to believe it. And I understand that and I accept that." Bush told a New Orleans television station last week that FEMA will perform better next time because the agency has learned from last year's fiasco. Well, there's been a few problems, it seems. The U.S. General Accounting Office, an independent watchdog, randomly sampled 250 payments made to Katrina victims and found that 16% were doled out to fraudulent recipients. That would account for the $1 billion in misspent money, the GAO says. Recipients listed post office boxes, UPS stores, and cemeteries as addresses for damaged properties, and they still got the cash. The GAO itself set up a bogus restraint who gave the address of a vacant lot, and he received a check for almost $6,000. Even after a FEMA inspector told staff the bogus registrant didn't live at the address and another official said the damaged property couldn't be found. The GAO also found millions of dollars, the New York Times estimates $10 million, that were paid out to inmates in a federal and state prison situation. FEMA also lost track of 750 assistance debit cards worth $1.5 million, and the GAO found the cards were used for a Caribbean vacation, pro football tickets, and pornography. The blatant fraud, the audacity of the schemes, and the scale of the waste is just breathtaking, said Senator Susan Collins, a Maine Republican who chairs the Homeland Security Committee. The Times, in a report last month, went beyond the GAO and estimated that FEMA wasted $2 billion on fraudulent scams and foolish spending, more than 10% of the $19 billion that FEMA spent on Hurricane Katrina and Rita. FEMA, the paper reported, spent $7.9 million to renovate a former Army base in Alabama, but only 10 evacuees stayed there each night at a cost of $416,000 per person. The human suffering also brought out the worst in some Americans, A hotel owner in Texas was charged with submitting a $232,000 bill to FEMA for fictional evacuees allegedly staying at that hotel. Two additional FEMA employees and officials pleaded guilty to accepting $20,000 in bribes, the number of meals that a contractor was serving to disaster workers. Okay, and just to close off the show is an announcement from MNN, which is the Mohawk Nation News, concerning the Six Nations and the reclamation standoff up in Caledonia. This request was dated August the 25th. The men and women from the Six Nations reclamation site are asking for brothers, sisters, friends, and allies to reach into their pocket and help them last out the winter. They're going to continue to stay, and it's getting cold. Since February the 28th, they've been there on the land formerly known as Douglas Creek Estates near Caledonia. They wanted to stop the continued illegal encroachment on their territory, and they've held steadfast despite many attacks from courts, governments, OPP, and even the United States Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Task Force. Why they were there, we don't know. They continue to stay. The talks with Canada and Ontario government is continuing despite the attempt of one renegade judge to interfere, and says there's lots of money, tons of money on the other side, but they don't have a cent, and to stay there despite the rednecks and bureaucratic machines that try to steamroll them, they need some help financially. So if you're interested in helping them stay there and taking back the land, and actually it's one good way to get rid of urban sprawl problems and probably the only way to get rid of urban sprawl problems. They would greatly appreciate donations sent to the Six Nations through several ways. One is the MNN, which is Mohawk Nation News website, and you get there by going www.mohawknationnews.com. On there, you'll find a link called Donation, and you can use PayPal for that. You can send a check to Janie, that's J-A-N, i.e. Jameson, and you can mail it to RR number 6, Hagersville, Ontario, Canada. And the postal code up there is N as in Norman, 0A as in all of them, 1HELP0. That is RR number 6, Hagersville, Canada, postal code NOA1HO, or you can do bank deposits at the Bank of Montreal. The transit number is 3752. That is 3752. The account you can put the money into is 3011-285. That account number, once again, is 3011-285. If you want to get in touch by email, contact Hazel Hill at The Basket Case, that's all one word, at on.aibn.com. You can try calling her at 519-445-0719 or 519-865-7722. And 905-517-7006. Now, that number that I just read, the 905-517-7006, I don't think that's to Hazel, but you can call that anyway. And so there you go. If you want to help the Six Nations stay on their land, as they say, send a donation and contact them. Thanks. Next week, we have another version of Seeds of Hope. Actually, it's the Jammin' Show that we missed last week. So if you missed that and you were looking for that, it will be on this coming Thursday, August 31st at 12:30. And that is Seeds of Hope. Tune in again next week on Tuesdays at noon for more versions of The Other Side. Thanks.
Radio. 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 Radio.